Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for your patience. And I want to particularly thank those of you who are in overflow rooms or in corners. This is obviously an issue of high interest to the people in this city, and I regret we don't have more space in the chamber, but we'll just ask everyone to bear with us. By way of run of show today, I just want you to know that we're going to start with a couple of statements. I will make a statement. I will ask Commissioner Udaly, who's my co-sponsor, to make a statement. We'll hear the formal presentation from the committee, and I'm told that lasts 30 to 35-ish minutes. And after that, my colleagues and I will have an opportunity to put some amendments on the table. I know we already have some interest in amendments. I intend to put one on, and I know some of my colleagues do. And after that, what I propose is we open this right up to public testimony. The council will not deliberate tonight. We want to hear from the public, and then we'll get everybody in, think 2 minutes for testimony, and then we will continue the hearing to another day where we will do the deliberation and take the vote. But today's really going to be about hearing the presentation and hearing from the public at large. I have one bit of housekeeping that I'm required to do since we were just in a special committee hearing environment for the Prosper Portland. I now have to reconvene us as the Portland City Council, which we are doing, and I need to call the roll again, Carla.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. So, colleagues, we have the burden of knowledge. 100 years ago, when many of the masonry buildings were built in our city, they did not know that they were building those buildings in an environment that is subject to potentially lethal earthquakes. Now we do know that. We also know, and one of the reasons there's a lot of people here in the chamber and in the overflow rooms, that there is a substantial cost potentially to mitigating that risk. The costs range from relatively minor for certain kinds of safeguards to potentially very significant for other kinds of safeguards. The focus from the committee and what we asked them to do was predominantly focused on life safety issues. Knowing that what we know now about living in a fault environment, what can we do to protect people's lives and protect property in the event of the inevitable, which is a large-scale earthquake? So as we looked at the proposals which are being offered up by the committee, and I will tell them many times over the course of this process, I'm really, really exceptionally pleased with the hard work and the diligence that they put into this task. There's lots of weighing that we have to do, including the timelines. We don't know when a big earthquake will strike this city. It could be tomorrow, or it could be 100 years from now. We don't know. We do know there will be a large-scale earthquake at some point. And so part of the analysis that my colleagues and I have to do is to figure out what is a reasonable time frame and what makes sense from a probabilistic perspective. We also have to balance the various costs, particularly costs that might be incurred by those who can least afford the mitigation measures. We have questions about what these costs mean in terms of protecting life safety. We have questions about what it means in terms of the affordability of commercial space. We have questions about what it means in terms of the affordability of housing. We have opportunities around incentive programs to help mitigate those costs. We certainly have opportunities around other types of financial strategies, and we can talk about that later. So keeping in mind that we now do have this burden of knowledge, I believe we have an affirmative responsibility to be prepared for when the big one does strike. I want to begin by calling attention to the seismic risk that Portland faces. I understand, as I just said, that the chance of A large earthquake may seem negligible to many people, but I also understand that there's people who tell us that we need to approach this issue with urgency. We have the opportunity to make some major changes now so that we can preserve the most lives. We can protect buildings that are both old and historic, and we can prepare for economic resilience. I have heard over and over in the last few weeks that this is not the right time. And I've got to tell you, there is never going to be a good time. We have to move forward. The question is, how do we do it, and how do we minimize the fiscal impact on people who own and people who lease the properties that we're discussing? I made no secret that some of my priorities as mayor include housing and homelessness, and I want to do everything in my power to ensure that whatever policy comes forward is intentional and well thought out and does the best that it can to preserve housing and avoid displacement and maintain affordability. My goal is, of course, to make Portland a great place for everyone to live, and to live securely and to live safely. An earthquake is not going to discriminate based on age or race or income level or anything else. It may discriminate based on the kind of structure that you were in at the time that the earthquake strikes. I say that to highlight that I hear different people prioritize different things. Let's all start with the assumption we know there is a life safety issue. Do we all agree on that? There is a life safety issue, and we should address it. And I think everybody I've heard agrees with that. There are different priorities. I've heard many people say the front of the line should be schools, that we should do whatever we can and make whatever kinds of investments publicly to protect the kids who are in our schools, who are in fact required to be in our schools. Children should be a priority, but that doesn't happen only by retrofitting schools. That also happens by making sure that the buildings in which children live or buildings in which their parents work are also protected. I do not want to in any way minimize the financial burden that retrofitting could potentially impose on building owners and renters, and that's why I've now said it three times. I know this because I want to direct city bureaus to get serious about retrofitting our own buildings. We are the largest single owner of URM, unreinforced masonry buildings, so I understand the challenge we face. We're not going to require the public to do something that we are not going to require of ourselves. We're going to be right there. A Cascadia event here will not only be a natural disaster, but most importantly, a failure of the infrastructure that will result in the loss, potentially, of many lives, increased blight, and the potential to halt our economy. It's our responsibility to make Portland a great place to live now and to protect this city into the future for future generations. We obviously have a lot of work yet to do on resilient infrastructure, and it's going to take dedication, time, and partnership with Multnomah County, the state of Oregon, and other willing partners to get us to the place where we need to be. This is merely a first step to direct more work to be done, and I want to emphasize that. This is merely the first step. Today you're going to hear from the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. This policy is one of the many initiatives that the Bureau is working on to increase resilience in Portland. They've also dramatically increased the number of neighborhood emergency team members. They've increased community resilience efforts, and they continue to guide the City of Portland in emergency plans and continuity of operations planning. I want to thank all of the members right up front of the Retrofit Standards Committee, the Support Committee, and the Policy Committee. You've collectively worked for over 4 years. You've conducted many meetings. You've heard from various stakeholders. And you've painstakingly negotiated the policy that, for the most part, represents all of your diverse interests. I'd also like to thank the staff that worked with the committees and shared their insights to bring this policy here for our consideration. I'd now like to give my co-sponsor, Commissioner Hugh Daly, the opportunity to share a few introductory remarks as well. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm afraid I might be reiterating a little bit of what you've already said, but I'll keep it brief. First, I want to acknowledge that this has been a long, difficult process, and everybody involved deserves credit for continuing to work through these challenging issues. I have had more conversations about URMs than possibly any other topic since taking office. And as the mayor mentioned, this current conversation has been going on for 4 years. So we're really coming in midstream and having to look backwards and forwards at this issue. It's been a real challenge to figure out how to balance life safety and resiliency with the potential financial burden on building owners and impacts on affordability. And I think if there's any consensus in the room today, it's that we haven't figured that out yet. So today will hopefully be a great opportunity to reflect on the status of this conversation, to talk about the work that has yet to be done, especially figuring out how to pay for all of this. So, because as the mayor also mentioned, I think we do all agree that life safety and keeping our streets clear of debris in the event of a large earthquake is something we all care about. I personally strongly support the public's right to know about the seismic safety of buildings that they occupy, which is another issue that's up for debate. But I'm certainly looking forward to hearing more about how we can best accomplish that this afternoon. And now I have several thank yous. First, I want to thank Amit Kumar, Senior Structural Engineer at BDS, who's been a tireless resource for all of the committees, providing guidance and historical knowledge. He and his team have done a great job of boiling down complex engineering info into clear policy choices with consequences that are understandable to most everyone involved. Thank you to Shelley Duquette and Eric Thomas, structural engineers at BDS. They have supported this work with technical expertise and local experience working on seismic upgrade projects. Thank you, Jake Brown, BDS GIS analyst, who's been instrumental in making URM information available for all via the Portland Maps website. His work has made up-to-date information accessible to building owners, residents, tenants, and the general public. Thank you, Shelley Hack from Prosper Portland, who has led the city's work on financial incentives and financing tools that are going to be crucial to the work that still needs to happen. Thank you to Margaret Mahoney, former director of BDS, when it was the Bureau of Buildings. I like that name. Who's chaired the policy committee. And finally, thank you, Reed Zimmerman of KPFF Engineers, who's provided great insight from his engineering perspective.
Very good. Thank you. So we'll start with Jana Papaethimiou to share the staff recommendations for unreinforced masonry seismic retrofit. Good afternoon.
Excuse me, Mayor. I haven't read the title.
I'm sorry?
The title. I need to read the title.
Oh, very good. Go for it.
Item 458, Direct Bureau of Emergency Management, Bureau of Development Services, and Prosper Portland to develop unreinforced masonry building mandatory retrofit implementation steps and return to council for adoption within 1 year.
Very good. Thanks, Carla. Good afternoon, John.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Jana Papaethimiou, the Planning and Resilience Manager at the City of Portland's Bureau of Emergency Management. I am joined today by Amit Kumar from the Bureau of Development Services and Shelley Hack from Prosper Portland. I am delighted to be here this afternoon to present to you the culmination of 4 years of work on the subject of unreinforced masonry buildings. This is work that was done by myself and my colleagues, but also supported by many staff within our bureaus and led for many years by Carmen Merlot, the Carmen for previous director of PBEM. It was also guided by generous and well-informed stakeholders who have held on through what proved to be a much longer process than we initially anticipated. And and there are their names. I'd particularly like to thank Margaret Mahoney, our chair, who will speak after the staff presentation. I'd also like to acknowledge the Standards Committee, and Brian Emmerich is here to speak on their behalf. And finally, the Financial Support Committee, which is today represented by Walt McMonies. We've been to Council several times in the past 2 years to present our work on risk, building science, costs, and financial tools. So the presentation today will just summarize all the work we've done up to this point, but I invite you to ask questions if I gloss over anything that deserves more attention. I'll start by providing an overview of our risks and an inventory of the buildings that are most at risk. I don't want to spend a long time on process, but I would like to take time to really explain the elements of a URM retrofit that we're asking building owners to do, how much we think it'll cost, and the financial supports that we believe are necessary to move that work forward. I sincerely wish I could close by presenting an ordinance ready for you to adopt, which would solve this problem. But instead, we'll end with a resolution that's intended to provide direction to city staff as they continue to work in several realms to address this complex issue. I do hope that by directing these next steps, we'll provide some welcome certainty to everyone involved in this project. Of course, all our work is predicated on the fact that Portland can expect a major earthquake in the future. So I'd like to ask Dr. Chris Goldfinger, who is director of the Active Tectonics and Seafloor Mapping Lab at Oregon State University and a foremost expert on the Cascadia Subduction Zone, to present a few moments on our earthquake risk. Dr. Goldfinger.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Thanks, Jonna. Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, I'm happy to be here, and it's really a pleasure to see this under public discussion. I've been working on this problem since 1987, and we started out wearing tinfoil hats, and people thought we were crazy, and now here we are. So I could just put up an image of the old bumper sticker that says "Nature Bats Last" and ask if there are any questions, but it is really that simple. Your jobs are complex. My job is very simple. I essentially just speak for the earth as we interpret it. And to get across a little bit of how abrupt the earth is when it does speak, I was at an earthquake meeting in Kashiwatiba, Japan, on the day of the last earthquake. And we were in the middle of changing PowerPoint slides when the earthquake started. And in the space of 3 minutes, we saw not only a magnitude 9 earthquake unfold during an earthquake meeting, but we saw a paradigm change, because Japan was completely unprepared for, not for an earthquake, but for the size of the earthquake that they had. And at that moment, when it starts, all discussion ends. There's no more. Everything that you've done up to that point, that's what you're going to have as a result. All the building codes, the preparation, all of that. So although it's just another issue, it's an issue like no other. It could start in the next 5 seconds in this building. And so having been there and ridden through it, I actually get a little bit nervous coming to Portland, because I look around and I see a lot of URM buildings, and I give a lot of earthquake talks, and almost every one of them is in a URM building. And when I head down I-5 towards Corvallis, then I can relax a little bit, because it's not going to happen that day. So with that, let me just run through a little bit of the nuts and bolts of Cascadia earthquakes. First of all, one thing you should know is that even though we're unprepared in the sense of building codes and preparation aspects, Cascadia has gone from one of the worst known faults in the world in 1985 to one of the best today. And so we're in a good position. We're actually far better off than Japan was in 2011. And so we have very reliable numbers. We've had a lot of people working on this for a lot of years. And because it's so enigmatic and we didn't have we haven't had an instrumental recorded earthquake in history, it sort of prompted people to dig into how we can unearth the past records. And so we're in a really good place from that perspective. So essentially we have three hazards here. We have the subduction zone that's underneath us. We have crustal faults that are closer to Portland, the Portland Hills Fault, the East Bank Fault, and others that are probably unknown. And then we have the Juan de Fuca Plate underneath us, about 50 kilometers down, that has its own faults as well. And it generates earthquakes like the Nisqually earthquake of 2001. Unfortunately, those other faults are very, very poorly known. Their repeat times are unknown, which means when you try to calculate a probability for those, you can't. There's just no data whatsoever. And so when we talk about probabilities for an earthquake, we're really talking about only Cascadia, where we have lots and lots of data. And that's good. The problem is, though, that numbers I'm going to give you are minimum probabilities because they don't include the other two earthquake sources. So they're the absolute minimum. The true probabilities are much higher, but we just don't know how much higher. So the subduction zone, the subducted slab, and crustal faults. And so mostly I can really only talk about the subduction zone. So this is a map of subduction zone ruptures, seven different types that have been outlined over 30 years of paleoseismology, working offshore and working in coastal bays. And so we have 47 earthquakes in total over 10,000 years. About 30 of them reach the latitude of Portland. So there's some that are confined to the southern part and won't affect us here, but about 30 of them reach the latitude of Portland, and so the probability numbers you'll hear refer to those 30. And about half of them run the full length of the subduction zone, the upper left box in that image. And so the minimum magnitudes for those are thought to be about 8.7 to 8.8, and the maximum tops out at about 9.2. So that's about half of them are very, very big earthquakes. Just for reference, the earthquake that destroyed San Francisco in 1906 was a 7.9. So that's it's not quite a fair comparison because the San Andreas Fault was 1 mile from San Francisco and Cascadia is roughly 50 miles to the west of us. But what Cascadia lacks in proximity, it makes up for in duration. So subduction zone earthquakes tend to go for 2 to 3 to even 4 minutes. The 2004 earthquake in Sumatra went for 6 minutes. So shaking a fragile infrastructure, even fairly gently, for that long makes up for that distance. So down to the numbers, the probability for a magnitude. You hear a lot of different numbers for probabilities, and one number you hear a lot is 10 to 15%, and that number refers to magnitude 9 earthquakes. That is the top-end earthquakes of those 47. So there are lots of smaller ones. And if you look at probabilities for anything big enough to affect Portland, that is essentially magnitude 8 or greater, the range is 22 to 26% in the next 50 years. And 50 years is the usual time span, a sort of customary time span that people can understand, and it's statistically meaningful. And so, but remember, that's the minimum probability. It doesn't include the crustal faults, doesn't include Portland Hills Fault, East Bank Fault, or slab earthquakes like Nisqually in 2001. So these are absolute minimum numbers. It also doesn't include earthquakes smaller than about magnitude 7.5 or so. And so there may be some of those that are from the subduction zone as well. So magnitudes are highly variable, and we know the timing of these earthquakes pretty well. We know the length of them pretty well. We don't know their magnitudes all that well. So these are fairly crude guesses. Okay, so the last Cascadia earthquake was 317 years ago. It was a magnitude 9, which we know quite well from a tsunami that propagated to Japan. And so the average repeat time for anything in Cascadia, magnitude 8 or greater, is about 240 years. So we're 317 years into an average repeat time of 240. So we're past the median. In Portland, at the latitude of Portland, since we're dealing with a bit smaller number, the average here is about 335 years, and we're just about exactly at the average repeat time. And just for reference, we all think we understand probabilities, and none of us, including me, really do. But just for reference, in Japan and Tohoku, people thought the probability of an M9 earthquake there was zero at the time it happened. It turned out it was really about 20%. So on the day the earthquake happened, their probability based on past records was 20%. And so what will it be like in Portland? And I mentioned that the earthquake that destroyed San Francisco was a 7.9. It was much closer, shook the ground much harder, and it was a lot closer. So, but it's still a good reference point. Cascadia is further away, but shakes longer. And I've kind of already said everything on this slide, I think. So the maximum ground motion here is thought to be about 0.3 g. That's the unit we use for ground accelerations. And 0.3 g is fairly light. You know, you pull more g's when you hit a speed bump in the parking lot. It doesn't seem like much. But if that gentle shaking for several minutes is more than enough to dismantle most URM buildings. It's more than you need. And so I'll just wrap it up with a picture of San Francisco. And when you think about analogies for Portland, San Francisco in 1906 is really not a bad analogy. Although we've got a lot of new buildings here and modern buildings, if you remove those from the picture, then you get something like San Francisco in 1906. And this is just one of, you know, millions of pictures that were taken of the city at the time. And so the level of destruction is nearly complete in that kind of situation when you have a large building stock. This is not just damaging buildings. We're talking about large piles of debris is all you have left. So I think my 5 minutes are up. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is it Dr. Goldfinger?
Yes.
Okay. So you mentioned you were in Japan when they had their last major earthquake. And you said at that point the debate was over. Am I quoting you? I wanted to ask you if the debate was over in regard to do we need stricter codes or not, or was it some other?
Do you mean for here?
I got the impression you were in Japan. They had an earthquake, and I think you said it ended the debate. What debate did it end?
Well, so in Japan, up to 2010, they were debating the geology. And geologists were starting to present new information that there were much bigger earthquakes than historically. They'd had 1,000 years of magnitude 8.4 or smaller. Okay. And so the debate was going on. TEPCO, the nuclear power plant operator, and the government were saying, well, this is national policy. This is 8.4 is all we've ever had. But the geologists found evidence of magnitude 9 earthquakes. And so there was a debate. And essentially the geologists were sort of shouted down in that case and told to that their evidence wasn't strong enough and come back later when you publish more evidence and so forth. But obviously the debate ended on that day.
And so it wasn't so much a debate about the need for stricter seismic codes or anything like that. It was really more just the probability of that large of an earthquake.
Yeah, well, that led into the debate about codes because their maximum magnitude was 8.4. And so if you're engineering, as Kent would tell you, for an 8.4, it's a very different thing than an engineering for a 9 that might last three times as long. So there was significant debate. And in their case, you know, we're 50 miles inland, but in their case, they had nuclear power plants right on the beach. Yeah. And so the size of the tsunami was a very big issue as well.
Okay. Thank you.
So earthquakes shake all the buildings. So why are we focused on URM buildings? To answer that question, I'd like to introduce Dr. Kent Yu, who's a structural engineer, the former chair of OSPAC, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee, and the lead author of the Oregon Resilience Plan.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you, commissioners. What I want to do is, before I start, I'd like to invite you to watch a movie. On the left-hand side, what you see is a modern construction that will work. On the other side is an unreinforced masonry board. All right, so what is unreinforced masonry building? By definition, unreinforced masonry means that there is no reinforcement in the wall. And long time ago, when contractors built unreinforced masonry buildings, what they normally do is they lay down bricks for every 5 or 6 courses, then they turn the brick by 90 degrees and add another layer over there, tie the interior face and exterior face of the wall together, and they repeat the same process all the way to the floor level. Once they reach the floor level, what they do? They create some pockets in the wall so that they can accommodate floor beams. And then they continue the process to the roof, and past the roof level, they stop at the top of the parapets. So generally, there is no positive connection between the floor to the wall and between the floor to the wall. Go to Nick. So during the earthquake, what happens is that the wall tends to fall away, move away from the building. In order to prevent the wall from falling off, we have to rely on the ties connecting the floor to the wall, connecting the roof to the wall. And then once the forces is transferred to the roof and the floor, then we are relying on the connection between the roof to the side wall, floor to the side wall, dump the forces to the side walls, and from the side walls, we dump the force down to the foundation. Okay. So what happens is that during the earthquake, because there is no positive connection between the floor and the wall, and so what you normally see is these walls tend to fall away from the building. On the slide, what you see is the 1993 Scotts Mills earthquake. On the top is the Molalla High School. Earthquake took place during a spring break. Because at the top of the building, we normally see very high acceleration. So the parapets together with the wall on the top level, they just fall away from the building. In 2001, I went to the Squally earthquake a few days afterwards. And as you can see, that we see the same phenomenon. Essentially, the parapets and the wall on the top level just peel away from the building. And if you happen to be the building next to one of the buildings, you could get hurt. I also want to show you a few slides we got from a Christchurch earthquake. This one is before the earthquake. This one shows after earthquake. This is before the earthquake. This is after earthquake. So it is very, very critical to make the positive connection, to brace our parapets, to tie the roof to the wall. Now, once we tie the wall to the floor level, to the roof level, there is another potential deficiency we have to address. If the wall is too tall, if the wall is too thin, the wall could bow out and collapse on its own. This is a photo also taken from Christchurch earthquake. If we put this building in Oregon, in Portland today, how should we brace this building to prevent pulling out failure? We cannot simply tie the roof diaphragm to our exterior wall. We have to make multiple points of connection to prevent pulling out of our end walls here. So these red dots represent the location we have to put all these attachments, tie-ins. So over the years, in the United States, in many parts of the world, we have implemented different level of retrofits. And I want to talk about those retrofit techniques, ideas, and also the associated performance as well. First thing you can do is that you simply tie the your roof to the exterior wall and also brace the parapet. That helps you prevent parapet falling onto the street. However, because the floor is not connected to the wall, so the wall still can bow out and cause the building to collapse. So next thing we can do is that to the right is we add an additional tie the exterior wall to the floor, and that will help us prevent the wall from bowing out at floor elevation. However, if we have wall too tall or too slender, the wall still can bow out and collapse onto its own. Third level, we said, well, since the wall can bow out, let's add some strong backs made of steel or timber so we can prevent the wall from bowing out between two floor levels. This retrofit has clearly addressed the many apparent deficiencies in our buildings. But there are many, oftentimes we also, in our building, there are many other deficiencies. If we don't address other deficiencies, the building still could collapse. So this retrofit, as a structural engineer, we don't recognize this as full-blown life safety retrofit. If we want to go full-blown life safety retrofit, we have to go to the right-hand side. Essentially, look at the building, look at the building configuration, look at the building condition, look at the quality of construction, look at the stiffness strength distribution over the height of the building. Once we do the analysis, then we can able to properly retrofit the building so that make sure the building will perform in a life-safe manner. So as I mentioned earlier that unreinforced masonry, if they are not retrofitted, they pose significant life safety risk to the occupants in the building, to the pedestrian on the sidewalk. In addition to that, it also could delay our post-event response and recovery and affect our citywide economy as well. So the photo on the left is taken from Napa earthquake. As you can imagine, the building has partially collapsed. After the event, the area around the building was cordoned off. The distance between the yellow tape and the face of the building is roughly about 1.5 times of the building height. Until we put an emergency shoring or demolishing in place, we cannot get close to the building. So if we have max line, if we have a broken water pipe, if we have down power lines, we cannot go there to restore those utilities. So that is a major concern for us. Because of those concerns, in Oregon Resilience Plan published in 2013, we identified unreinforced masonry as the single most dangerous type of building in our society. We must take aggressive measure to address the threat to our society, not only from a life safety point of view, but also for the post-disaster response and recovery point of view. So in conclusion, I strongly, as a structural engineer, support. We need to take a positive action, aggressively address the threat to our community, to protect our people and to protect our community.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. So, early in our work, the Bureau of Development Services undertook a comprehensive update of our URM building inventory, and we feel that we now have a robust accounting of all our URM buildings. There are about 1,650 of them in the city, not including single-family homes. More than 85% are commercial buildings, offices, warehouses, retail. And there are also about 7,200 residential units in URMs. About 1,800 of these are publicly financed affordable housing. The city itself owns about 40 URMs, from Union Station to the Kenilworth Parth restrooms. The average URM is nearly 90 years old, and more than 550 of them have some type of historic designation. More than half of URM buildings, fortunately, are just one story. The complete URM inventory is available on portlandmaps.com. URM buildings were constructed between about 1860 and 1960, so they're clustered around historic main streets and town centers. The Northwest District is the neighborhood with the most URMs. That's followed by Buckman, Downtown, and Old Town Chinatown. This knowledge of our earthquake risk and the special risks that URM pose in Portland are what led the City Council to direct the Bureau of Emergency Management, Prosper Portland, and BDS to initiate this effort in May of 2014. We developed a phased project that reflected a commitment to do work fundamentally based in good science and best practices in the development profession. So we designed a process that started with a technical committee that was charged with providing recommendations on retrofit standards, then a support committee to develop financial options, and finally a policy committee that was intended as a sort of conference committee that would knit together the recommendations of both groups into a coherent program to address this issue. The policy committee included members of both the financial and technical committees, as well as stakeholders representing schools, churches, affordable housing, and historic preservation interests. The committee was intended to meet for about 6 months, but ended up meeting for nearly 2 years. And again, for a reason we owe a special debt of gratitude to these volunteers, who worked on a consensus basis to make their recommendations. They organized their own subcommittees on affordable housing and not-for-profits and historic buildings, and they hosted open house events for both tenants and building owners, and they invited and received a great deal of public testimony at every meeting. Their work also generated significant media interest, and staff took the committee's work on the road, presenting at more than 20 different community venues. Something you know if you came to one of our presentations is the fact that URM retrofits work. This is the Orem building in Paso Robles, California. It was destroyed in the 6.5 San Simeon earthquake in 2003. It's the Acorn building. The building collapsed and two people inside were killed. This is a retail store three doors down on the same street. It's also a URM building, but it was retrofitted a few years before. It sustained minor damage and it was able to reopen the same week. Retrofits like Julia's gifts just aren't happening in Portland right now. Here, the code says a partial retrofit is required when you replace more than half the roof. You have to brace the parapets and tie the wall to the roof. That's good because it protects passersby from architectural elements that could fall off and hurt people on the sidewalk, even with light shaking. But it doesn't protect people inside the building from a stronger earthquake. That kind of retrofit to a life safety standard just happens when there's a major renovation or a change of use. The building goes from warehouse to lofts, or a historic hotel gets totally renovated. Since 1994, only 5% of URM buildings have been retrofitted to that standard. Based on this information and a review of retrofit programs in other cities, the committee concluded that Portland's current code is not sufficiently effective, and that in general, passive triggers and incentive programs alone are not sufficient to address our risk. They recommend that all Portland URMs be retrofitted to improve safety to a standard that is appropriate to the building's use, the number of people inside, and the purpose it is expected to serve both before and after the earthquake. Towards this end, the committee designated four classes of URM buildings, from fire stations to storage sheds. The categories themselves were not very difficult to agree on, but the level of retrofit appropriate to each category was the subject of debate for over a year within the committee. To understand the trade-offs of risk and costs inherent in the choice, we need to see what actually happens when we retrofit a URM. So here we go. We're looking at a section of a wall through a URM building, and I'm describing a typical retrofit to the American Society of Civil Engineers standards. It has these key elements. First, we brace the parapets. That's what we talked about. It's already required by code. This is what keeps them from falling off. Next, we tie the walls to the floor. Again, this is required in the current code, and it can be as simple as it sounds. It's a bolt and some glue. Then we strengthen the roof diaphragm. Now this sounds a lot more complicated, but think about it this way. URM buildings are old. They were made before plywood was invented. So the roof is just boards nailed to the rafters, nailed to the beams. All those different pieces of wood nailed together 50 years ago can move independently in an earthquake. That's no good. So we make sure they're tied together, and then we cover the whole thing with plywood so they move as one unit during an earthquake. That means they can shore up the rest of the building. Next, we attach the wall to the floor. That's like attaching the wall to the roof. Next, we do the out-of-plane wall bracing. This is what Kent was describing with the strong backs, where we prevent the wall from moving out of plane and falling out or into the building during an earthquake. And finally, we do other upgrades that could be required. This includes cross bracing, strengthening the foundation, or resheathing the interior floors, the same as we did on the roof. So, those are the steps of a URM retrofit. When we do a retrofit, we do all those steps to meet a performance standard. That's a level of performance we want to see in the building during an earthquake. The American Society of Civil Engineers recognizes four performance standards. The highest is immediate occupancy. This is where you want your hospitals. The next is damage control. This is a building that can be repaired and reoccupied fairly quickly. The next standard is life standards, life safety. This is the current standard for existing buildings that are new construction or retrofit of a URM building. If you're in a life safety building during an earthquake, you should duck, cover, and hold on. Then you should be able to exit the building safely, but it may not be repairable, so you may never go back inside. Finally, the lowest standard is collapse prevention. You can't build a new building just to meet collapse prevention standards, but with an old building, you can retrofit it so that it may be badly damaged, you may not be totally safe inside, but it isn't expected to come down all at once. The policy group agreed pretty early on that critical buildings should be retrofitted to immediate occupancy. Then schools and community centers that would be essential to earthquake recovery when we're trying to provide relief to citizens and get back to normal life go to damage control. They initially looked to have most other buildings meet something like a life safety light standard, because that's what's been used in California, and that's what's been proposed in Seattle. This is a price that really gave building owners sticker shock, because it can still cost a lot to perform all the steps that I just described. That's why in the course of their deliberations, the policy committee eventually reached the consensus that life safety was just too costly for most building owners given the resources available. While they felt that this should continue to be a long-term goal for the city, they listened to building owners and honored a commitment to collaborate with each other. So they had to invent a new level of retrofit that it was appropriate to the amount of resources available. This standard is not a performance standard that's recognized by the American Society of Civil Engineers. It's not a performance level at all, where buildings set a performance goal and then do whatever it takes to achieve it. Rather, it's a prescriptive standard where all building owners follow the same steps to reduce the likelihood of collapse, regardless of the design of their particular building. So to be really clear, some buildings retrofitted to the collapse risk reduction standard might still collapse, but it's a lot less likely. And doing the retrofit is a lot cheaper, and the costs are more predictable. So what's in the collapse risk reduction standard? Well, we keep the parapet bracing, which is already required by code. We keep attaching the wall to the roof, which is also required by code. We also keep the diaphragm strengthening. This technically is not required in the current code, but when building owners do a re-roof of a historic building, they generally will always do this because you need a level, flat substrate to adhere your new roof to. If you don't do this, you can't get a warranty on the roof. So we're seeing a lot of resheathing of old buildings already. D, attach the wall to the floor, is the one element that's not commonly being completed that we propose to add. The out-of-plane wall bracing goes away. This can be important for some buildings, but it's also really disruptive to do the work because you have to strip out everything inside the building, the cabinets, the wall finishes, the paint, to get down to the wall and apply those strong backs. So we said, okay, we're going to let that go. And similarly, we let go of all the other upgrades that would be required. Those are the things like cross bracing, strengthening the foundation. Those can be important for some buildings, particularly buildings that either have a weak first story, so they have a lot of windows and openings and they're prone to twisting during an earthquake, or buildings that are irregularly shaped, like an H or an L-shaped building that has uneven forces acting on it. Those retrofits can be important, but they also are unpredictable in their cost, because when you dig into an old building, you can find a lot of other work you need to do. So we took them out. Okay, so now that the retrofit standards are hopefully matched in our minds to the work we actually do on a building, here they are again, matched with the building class and the number of buildings in each class. This is the hard part. We're like halfway through. Now I'm going to talk about timeline and cost. First, a word about cost. So the committee spent a lot of time trying to figure out how much it costs to actually retrofit a building to different standards. And they were mostly totally frustrated in this effort because seismic retrofits are almost always done as part of a larger project. So if you're doing a major remodel and having all your tenants move out, you're hiring a contractor and an architect, you're pulling permits, you're getting a loan, you're doing all this work, then that's a time that it makes sense to do the work. But if you're doing it as a standalone project, it's hard to figure out how much it would cost to do just that. We did find a few examples of these case studies in Portland, so we looked at them, we averaged them, and then we compared them to numbers published by FEMA for a national average for cost of URM retrofitting. And what we saw is that they mostly matched up. So the numbers I'm showing you here are from FEMA. And what they say to do a retrofit to immediate occupancy for those six Class 1 critical buildings, we expect to cost between $70 a square foot, that's just the hard costs, up to $110 if we put in a contingency and some soft costs and relocation of tenants. And we've agreed that 10 years is a reasonable amount of time to complete those steps for those six buildings. For Class 2, those schools and community centers that we think should get to damage control, the committee agreed on 10 years to brace the parapets and do the interventions required by current code, and then another 10 years to get to a full retrofit. And again, the cost estimates I'm showing there between $48 and $81 a square foot come from FEMA. All right. For Class 3 buildings, the committee agreed that 10 years to meet the current code and another 5 to do the wall floor ties was reasonable. To be clear, these are still much longer timelines than were used in other mandatory retrofit programs in California, but it's another area where the committee was working to accommodate the concerns of building owners and recognize the limited resources that are available to them. They also felt that this level of retrofit, although novel, was the correct minimum given the resources available. And how much do we estimate it would cost? $11 a square foot if you do it when you re-roof the building. How do we come up with this number? After the committee made the recommendation, Prosper Portland and the Bureau of Development Services selected a representative sample of URM buildings, 20 across the city. They produced standard details for the retrofit we've proposed, and they asked a professional construction cost estimator to tell them how much it would cost to do the work. What we saw is that, number one, re-roofing a building is really expensive. Next, the existing code requirements are adding already incrementally to that cost, about $4 a square foot. Next, if we require everyone to do the sheathing, it'll cost $8 or $9 a square foot more to do the roof. Again, that's a cost many people are already incurring because it improves the quality of the re-roofing job. And then doing the wall-to-floor attachments, which is only required if you have a building that's two or more stories, would cost between $3 and $5 per square foot additional. So, on average, meeting this requirement would add $11 per square foot to do the work. And then finally, those 200 URM garages and storage sheds. We recommend they have 10 years to comply with the current code, and it shouldn't cost anything extra because it's the code that's already in place. The committee also recommended strengthening triggers in the current code to make it harder for property owners to avoid doing upgrades when they are already re-roofing or doing a major remodeling project. So we're not proposing to change the standards here. We're just lengthening the timelines in which the cost or the coverage of the project is considered. It was also very important to the committee that the code be implemented in a fair way. And that starts with property owners being given adequate notice and a free opportunity to appeal their building's designation as a URM if they think it was done incorrectly. It's also important for building owners who have newer roofs, who have life left in their roof, to be able to apply for a timeline extension until it makes sense to replace the roof. Because when you do the parapet bracing and other thing, you've got to pull it off or poke holes in it, and that means you're losing your warranty. Based on input from the committee, the city also commissioned a cost-benefit study from an independent economist. This study was completed about halfway through our process when we were still looking to implement a life safety standard. So that's the one that gave a lot of building owners sticker shock. But even looking at these high costs, what we saw is that the cost outweighs the benefit by a good ratio, and that the ratio went up as the retrofit standard went down. So we expect that if we repeated this study now with our simplified standard, that the cost-benefit ratio would be even higher. Again, this was a study that just looked at the most tangible costs. We looked at how much it costs to permit the work and do it versus avoided damage, injury, and deaths. We didn't try to count anything like historic character or quality of the neighborhood or even the benefit to the local economy of hiring people to do this work, which could be significant. To be fair, we also weren't able to calculate the value of lost rents, which could also be significant. But we see this as being a good study, and also what it tells us is that what we're buying here is mostly lives and human suffering, because 55% of the calculated economic benefit is avoided death and injury. The committee recognized early on that the ownership structure and financial position of building owners can vary greatly. There are large property management companies, there are small investors, there are family businesses. They have different access to capital, they have different amounts of equity, they have different tolerance for risk. So a variety of financial supports is needed to make this work happen. The list I'm showing here represents concepts that the committee found were both financially feasible for the public to support and would have significant value to owners. The first one mentioned is Seismic C-PACE, which is being rebranded as Property Fit, but it's a financing tool. So it's a lien structure that can be used for improvements to private property that provide a level of public benefit. It's a financing mechanism. It's not free money, but it doesn't require an upfront investment, and it transfers upon sale. So it can have value for a lot of property owners if they have cash flow to support doing the work over time. SB 311 is money. It's a property tax exemption for up to 15 years on the value of the building to offset the cost of seismic improvements. Many members of the UN Policy Committee and staff traveled to Salem to lobby on behalf of this legislation last year, and we were really happy to see it pass. This state authorizing legislation allows us to implement the program locally, so the next step is to work with Portland Public Schools, Multnomah County, and other people that receive tax receipts in our jurisdiction to set up a program that can work here, and that's a recommended next step for the staff.
Is there any pushback from those jurisdictions to doing that?
We briefed the Portland Public Schools Legislative Advocacy Committee about it, and our colleagues in emergency management at Multnomah County, they certainly wouldn't want to agree to a program which has cost to them without having a longer discussion, but they're currently working on a brownfields tax exemption that this was modeled after, and those negotiations have been progressing, and it seems like they're going to agree to something. I think Portland Public Schools definitely sees the nexus between protecting students at school and at home, so I'm hopeful that we could reach an agreement on this, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
The other two items that have a legislative component are the state historic tax credit and a seismic tax credit. The state historic tax credit came forward in 2014 and it didn't pass, but we'd like to try again. It already exists in 38 other states and it's been valuable for property owners in retrofitting. Similarly, a seismic tax credit, we think this is novel. Other states haven't implemented it yet, but it seems like there is a public value in many jurisdictions in Oregon to promote seismic retrofits, and so we think this could have legs, and we'd like to take it to Salem. We also think it's important to recognize there are some folks that don't benefit from a property tax exemption, like not-for-profits, and that may have barriers to getting commercial financing. The city could establish a capital pool that could provide things like revolving loan fund or an interest rate buy-down, and that would make money available for folks to do that. We'd like to figure out how to fund that pool and how we would administer it and bring a program back to City Council to look at. And then finally, it was an important recommendation of the committee that property owners know that they have advocates they can come to, both at the Bureau of Development Services and at Prosper Portland. So staff people that understand URMs, that know the codes, and also know the resources that are available to people. And it's our recommendation that we develop a proposal to do that and bring it back. So these are the recommendations from the committee. I'd like to thank them again for their commitment to work on this contentious issue. And at this time, I'd also like to know that I think we owe sincere thanks to the folks we might call our local opposition. I mean, on behalf of myself and the policy committee, it was obvious that they demonstrated really intelligence and commitment to this issue. And they came to all our meetings, they challenged our work, and they changed it and they made it better. So we really recommend moving forward on these committee recommendations. I'd also like to show you two staff recommendations, both of which are related to public notification. The committee recommended that the city promote a state law to require all URM owners to notify tenants of a building's URM status. Staff feels like we need to explore further to see whether a statewide law would be feasible, but it's possible to move it forward with a local ordinance now, and we support doing that. It supports the public right to know. It lets people make informed decisions in their own interests. It could spark some good conversations about what to actually do in an earthquake. And we also saw that at our tenant open house, the majority of people who came did not know that they lived in the URM until after they signed the lease.
So we don't have something like that in place right now, or the county?
Nope. We have it with lead and other things, but not for URMs. The other recommendation is related to placarding. Placarding comes back to the fact that 85% of URM buildings are commercial buildings, so the people inside are employees, they're students, they're shoppers, and they'll never look at the lease. This placard also supports a public right to know, encourages that conversation about safety, and lets people just make their own decisions. This is an example of a placard in California where these notices are common because they're required by state law. There's some evidence that this has increased the rate of voluntary URM retrofits, and there's been no data demonstrating it harmed building owners. The signs are very widespread. All right, that was a lot. I'm almost done. I'd like to review the resolution before you right now, which is to direct staff to return to council within a year with changes to the building code to implement the mandatory seismic retrofit program I've described, to work with Multnomah County, Portland Public Schools, and others to implement the property tax exemption for URM building retrofits, to develop the proposal for the revolving loan fund, to develop a program of staff to assist unreinforced masonry building owners, For the city to assess its own URM buildings, the cost to retrofit them, and really to develop a strategy about how we would approach that, and to have a legislative agenda around historic and seismic tax credits. We also can bring forward, not necessarily yoked to those, the proposal for placarding and for disclosing the URM status to renters. All right.
Are those in the proposed resolution, Mayor? Those two steps?
They are.
They are in the proposed resolution.
So that concludes the staff presentation, but before I finish, I would just like to introduce two other people who have been important stakeholders in this discussion, and the first is Portland Fire Chief Mike Myers. Fire is an important public safety former partner for our bureau in terms of our neighborhood emergency team training and in other efforts to assist Portlanders after a national disaster.
Welcome, Chief.
Thank you, Mayor.